We got some budget policy, we got some tax policy, and we got some short selling from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosendahl. Thursday, the 16th of March. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. Think, if you will, of the White House budget plan that came out today as an expanded version of one of President Trump's tweets. More a sense of his thinking kind of thing than representative of real overall plan. Mick Mulvaney, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, said as much today of the document that is colloquially called the skinny budget.
This budget does not address the big picture items such as policy changes, revenue flows, tax policy, mandatory spending. This is simply the top line spending budget. It's why we call it the budget blueprint and not the full budget.
So if it's not the actual plan, what is it?
This is the message the president wanted to send to the public, to the press, to Capitol Hill.
Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explores what the White House is trying to tell us.
In a nutshell, President Trump wants more money for the military, less money for just about everything else, excluding entitlements. In some ways, it's textbook conservatism.
The president's budget proposal clearly lays out defense as the primary national priority.
Romina Baccia is a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The proposal cuts the EPA by 31%, the State Department by 28%, and the Health and Human Services budget by 18%.
The budget also shows a clear interest in returning power to states and localities.
But in at least one big area, Trump's priorities differ considerably from conservatives. Alan Viard is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute.
I think there are many conservatives who are rightly concerned about entitlement spending outstripping federal revenue.
Viard says the skinny budget makes no mention of the deficit, and the president has said he doesn't intend to touch Social Security or Medicare.
Well, I think it's tough to identify Donald Trump's philosophy. It seems like he says one thing and does another.
Carmel Martin is Executive Vice President for Policy at the Center for American Progress. Martin sees a contrast between Trump's rhetoric promoting working people and his proposed cuts to programs that serve them. Jared Bernstein is at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He goes further.
This budget is kind of looking out there at the landscape of American social policy and deciding that we're doing much too much for poor people.
But the budget process is long and complicated. Alice Rivlin is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Usually there are big changes made by the Congress.
So wherever Trump's budget is ideologically, it is unlikely to survive as is. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Alice Rivlin, by the way, also the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, much in the news of late. Not to be lost in all the skinny budget talk, President Trump is reminding people that tax reform is on his agenda, too. He told Tucker Carlson on Fox News last night that he wants to bring business taxes way down from 35 to 15%. There's no plan on how to do that yet from the White House, but we asked Marketplace Mitchell Hartman from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting to go have a look at what cutting taxes on businesses might mean.
President Trump has promised to introduce tax legislation to slash the top corporate rate from 35%, it's currently the highest among G20 economies, down to 15%. Though keep in mind, that 35%, a lot of companies don't pay it, says Len Berman at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center.
The average rate paid by U.S. corporations is actually comparable to a lot of European countries because there are lots of deductions and exclusions and preferences.
Maya McGinnis at the Fiscally Conservative Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says getting the top rate down
makes a whole lot of sense in terms of both growing the economy and increasing our competitiveness.
But she says it could also create a big hole in the budget.
To offset the huge cost of bringing the rates down, we're going to have to get rid of a lot of the existing tax breaks. Otherwise, it adds a whole lot to the debt, and that actually slows growth.
There are some prime targets for eliminating corporate tax breaks, says Frank Clementi at the liberal group Americans for Tax Fairness.
We're losing over $100 billion a year due to profit shifting that corporations do to low-tax jurisdictions, and the profits don't have to be taxed until they're repatriated, brought back to America.
President Trump has said he favors letting multinationals bring those profits home at a super low 10% tax rate. Reducing corporate deductions for things like interest and depreciation could raise more revenue. And simplifying the tax code is something most everyone, except maybe the corporate tax prep lobby, could get behind. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Well, look, at least it's Thursday, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Back to the budget here for a second and education. The $9 billion in cuts to the Department of Education that the White House is suggesting would hit a lot of programs designed to help low-income kids get into and graduate from college. And those changes, if they come to pass, could hit community colleges especially hard, where less than 40% of students graduate within 6 years. From the Education Desk at WYPR Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on the economics of higher ed.
At the North Campus of Miami-Dade College in Florida, more than half of students live below the poverty line. Malu Harrison is president. She says about 3 years ago, the community college started a food pantry where students can come to get donated groceries for themselves and their families.
An advisor or a counselor then follows up with them to see what other kinds of wraparound services they might need,
like tutoring or childcare assistance. There is plenty of demand for such services. A survey of 33,000 students in 24 states found that
2 in 3 students have some level of food insecurity, and 1 in 3 have such low levels of food security that they could be considered hungry.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is now a professor of higher education policy at Temple University. She founded the Wisconsin Hope Lab, which produced the survey. She says possible solutions include extending the federal free and reduced school lunch program to community colleges. Schools could also work with local authorities to provide subsidized housing.
Even though they are resource poor to begin with, they are going to have to take steps to start to address these needs if they want their students to succeed.
There is more pressure on all colleges for their students to succeed, from parents, accreditors, and government officials. More states are moving toward performance-based funding for colleges, which ties public money to measures like graduation rates. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Let's say you've got errands to run or stuff around the house that needs to get done and you just can't. You're busy or there's something else going on. TaskRabbit might be the answer. It's sort of like Uber, but for the everyday stuff of life. Stacey Brown Philpott is the CEO, and she is also today's conversation from the corner office. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So when you go to a dinner party or your kid's soccer game or, I don't know, out at the store and somebody says, so what do you do? What do you tell them?
I tell people I run a company that helps people find other people to do chores around their house.
And then when they look at you and go, huh, then what do you say?
If you need a handyman to put together some IKEA furniture or you need a TV mounted on the wall, we have an app that you can download and find somebody to do it in just a couple of clicks, 5 minutes.
And you are now in the midst of a big expansion after, it has to be said, growing pretty slowly for a long while.
Yeah, we're excited to launch TaskRabbit in 20 additional markets over the next 6 months. We have built a business that provides quality handymen in 19 cities, and we're excited to be in almost 40 cities within the next 6 months.
Are you guys profitable yet, by the way?
Very close to profitability. Yes, we're on that path.
Well, that's always good. Better to be on that path or not. Let me ask you a couple of questions about you, actually, because you have had an interesting route to get to TaskRabbit. From Detroit, you spent time at Goldman Sachs via Stanford and then Google before you got recruited to TaskRabbit. What was it that made you want to go to time at Google in its early days, why a sharing economy company?
You know, I fell in love with the vision of TaskRabbit, which is to revolutionize everyday work. And I grew up in the city of Detroit where a lot of people didn't have work opportunities, but they were good, hardworking people, including I had a single mom who took care of me and my brother. And so what we get to do at TaskRabbit is create jobs. I'm excited about the opportunity that we have to what I think of as creating everyday work for everyday people. And it was hard not to pass up a chance to create more jobs for people who I grew up with all over this country.
Okay, but here's the thing. As you know, as well as anybody else in this country, by virtue of what you do, the nature of work in this country is changing. The kinds of jobs, the pay of those jobs, all of those things. Is TaskRabbit a place where somebody can go and make a living in this new economy?
Yeah, the nature of work is definitely changing. People aren't interested in the days of wanting to spend 40 hours inside one building doing the same thing is ultimately, I believe, going to disappear. So on TaskRabbit, the average hourly wage is $35 an hour, which is five times the federal minimum wage. And so not only it's a flexible income, it's a meaningful income that people all over the country today are using to fill an income gap that they have and pay one to three major bills.
So this is going to sound maybe a little pointed, but, you know, what the heck? That sounds a lot like what the folks who run Uber say, right? Oh, yeah, it'll be great for you, and you can totally get by. And then you hear stories about drivers not getting health care and getting, expenses that they can't cover and all of those sorts of things. And so I go back to my previous question, which, although artfully you didn't quite answer, can you make a living working for TaskRabbit?
We have taskers who have made $150,000 a year. We have taskers who have paid for their kids to go to college. We have taskers who, you know, make $60,000 a year on TaskRabbit in addition to $50,000 in another job that they have. And for a lot of people, that's making more than a living. That's actually making a good living. We also offer things like training, and then we've partnered with various companies to offer portable benefits. Things like accessing health care or other retirement options are available through the marketplace.
This is kind of a more macro question, and I'd be curious to get your take. When do you think this idea of the changing nature of work will become the new normal, this idea that people have to dip in and dip out and do lots of things to get by? Because clearly that seems to be the way things are going.
I believe it's going to be sooner than we all think. Most of our taskers are part-time, but the phenomenon that we're seeing in the trend with them is that they're making more and more hours available to task on TaskRabbit. And as you've seen from the way the U.S. government is now tracking census data, they've started to track again income from independent contracting services because there's a recognition that that's the new normal, becoming the new normal of how people work.
Stacey Brown-Philpott, she is the CEO of TaskRabbit. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
We've got the rest of our conversation out now on our Corner Office podcast. Subscribe, give a listen, let us know what you think, but be gentle. Coming up, we can hear traders groaning. Oh, no! Now that is a day on Wall Street, I'll tell you what. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 15 points today, less than a tenth percent, 20,934. The NASDAQ basically flat, ended at 5,900. S&P 500 off 3 points, about a tenth percent, 2,381. Oracle beat expectations with its third quarter profit. Shares climbed 6.2%. Microsoft down about a tenth percent. Amazon pretty much flat. Healthcare stocks took a dive today. Anthem down 0.4%. Cigna off 1.4%. Aetna dropped 0.75%. High-end Toronto retailer Canada Goose made its stock market debut today. That's a company that makes those coyote fur-lined winter coats. It sells for like $1,000. Shares closed up 25% at $16.08. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about all the things we talk about on this program every single day,
technology, the economy, pop culture, politics, check out our podcast, Make Me Smart.
Molly Wood is my co-host.
Or maybe Kai Rizdahl is my co-host.
I don't know. Maybe. We've got new episodes every week.
And we have live Facebook videos and all kinds of other great stuff for you.
Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
And please follow us on Twitter for more. I am at Molly Wood.
And I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Check it out. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte is probably the happiest man in Europe today after the anti-Muslim and anti-EU candidate Geert Wilders did worse than expected in elections yesterday. Transatlantic economic attention now turns to Washington visits this week by two European leaders, both of whom have been critical of President Trump. Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny is in town for the annual St. Patrick's Day reception. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is at the White House tomorrow. Sally Herships has that one.
The U.S. is the world's biggest economy. Germany is Europe's. But President Trump and Chancellor Merkel have little in common. Ian Lesser is vice president for foreign policy of the Marshall Fund of the United States.
I mean, she is known for her sort of steadiness, but I don't think anyone would say overly charismatic approach to foreign policy. So this is quite a contrast.
A contrast in personality with a president who is known for being direct and outspoken. But there are big differences on policy, too. The biggest divide is trade. Trump is not happy about our trade deficit with Germany, $65 billion in goods alone. Peter Raschisch is a senior fellow with the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies.
Well, we'd like to see the Germans buy more U.S. products so that would help to bring the trade relationship into more balance.
President Trump has accused Germany of manipulating its currency, keeping the euro artificially low to boost its exports. And that could be awkward in his meeting with Merkel. But even if the two leaders really hit it off, it won't make much immediate difference. Germany is powerful, but it's just one country in the 28-member European Union. Jeff Rathke is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Trade is the responsibility of the European Commission. And individual European Union countries do not have the option of negotiating trade deals on their own.
Even so, both leaders realize relations between the U.S. and Germany, arguably the EU's most influential country, must be maintained, especially with key areas like trade and NATO at stake. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
You think you've had a tough week? Spare a thought here for hedge fund manager and sometimes activist investor Bill Ackman. Ackman and his company Pershing Square Capital Management sold their stake in the controversial pharmaceutical company Valeant on Monday, losing $4 billion in the process. That is not to say you ought to feel sorry for Ackman. He is personally doing fine, and he has a reputation for taking big and controversial stakes in companies that don't turn out so well. So there's that. But before Valeant, there was Herbalife, the nutrition and weight management company that Bill Ackman said and says in reality is a pyramid scheme and a fraud. And in a very public way 3 years ago, Ackman announced he was going to be shorting Herbalife stock to the tune of $1 billion. I'm going to let Bill Ackman himself explain here what a short is.
Imagine for a moment that a friend of yours collects rare coins, and you have the view that those coins are going to go down in value. So the way you would short those coins is you call up your friend and say, can I borrow a few of your coins? And he says, sure. And you borrow the coins. You then sell them for the $1,000 each that they sell for in the market at the time. And then you wait for them to drop in value. And you turned out to be right, and the coins dropped in value to $500. You go back into the market. You buy them back for $500. You've sold them for $1,000. You've repurchased them for $500. You've made $500 on each coin. And then you return the coins to your friend. Your friend is in the same place he was when he started, and he has the same coins that he started with. You might have to actually pay him something for borrowing the coins because he loaned them to you. So you might pay him an interest rate. So he's happy because he's made an interest rate. He's made interest lending you the coins. You've made money profiting from the decline in the value of the coins, and that's short selling. That's when it works.
When it works, being the key phrase there. The saga of Ackman's $1 billion short on Herbalife is the subject of a new documentary by Ted Braun. It's called Betting on Zero, for the price Ackman's hoping the company's stock goes to. The film is out in some theaters this weekend. Ted, thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Pleasure to be here, Kai.
Tell me why this story, which is kind of down in the weedy Wall Street-y kind of stuff. Tell me why the Bill Ackman Herbalife story got you.
I was intrigued by two elements right from the outset. Bill Ackman, hedge fund Wall Street titan, donning a white hat and going on a moral crusade. That's not something you expect every day.
Mm-hmm.
Herbalife, allegedly a massive multi-billion-dollar New York Stock Exchange listed pyramid scheme. And I thought, regardless of the outcome of this battle, something unexpected was going to happen and audiences would be surprised and I would as well. And I haven't been disappointed.
What do you make of Ackman's obsession with Herbalife because he, as he says in the film, spent $50 million investigating, tracking down, and then $1 billion investing in the demise of this company.
As he said publicly and as he says in the film, he invests money on behalf of a fund of investors that he has. And he, I think, has come to the judgment that this is an investment which is ultimately going to be very profitable for him. There is, however, another dimension, which is a sort of moral conviction that he is bringing to light a massive problem. And that moral dimension to his crusade, I think, has given him an additional fuel and has helped keep him and his investors in this fight for much longer than I think a lot of people expected.
This is not an original thought of mine. And in fact, somebody in your film says it. One of Ackman's investigators says it. Why would you ever take a moral issue to Wall Street?
I think he believes that by bringing this issue to Wall Street, he will also bring it to the attention of federal regulators, which I think, in fact, happened.
Yeah, and that not to spoil the end of the film, sure. but it has happened, right?
No, it has happened. It's a public fact. The Federal Trade Commission conducted a two-year investigation sort of paralleling the time of production. But I think also he felt that when the facts came to light and that when the government finally weighed in, the markets would respond. I think he was using the forum and the muscle that a fight on Wall Street has to provoke a public reaction as well as a regulatory reaction.
Can't talk about Ackman and Herbalife without talking about Carl Icahn and the titanic, for lack of a better radio-friendly phrase, spitting contest that those two engage in over Ackman's short and Icahn buying in to the stock in a very big way.
It was one of the most colorful moments, I think, in the history of business television.
Which is saying something, by the way.
It is saying something, yeah.
CNBC, those two are doing on the phone and literally yelling and screaming at each other.
They are. They are.
Billionaires.
I never said that I want to be friends with you, Bill. I wouldn't
okay.
be friends
okay,
with
Carl.
You. And
okay.
I would. You said
okay,
to me you'd like to be friends so that we could invest together.
Carl, I have no interest. Do you think I want to invest with you? Okay, let's move on.
I wouldn't invest with you.
Let's move on.
You're the last man on earth.
Let's move on.
Come on, you guys.
That's the reaction that a lot of people had while they were watching this unfold. It isn't in the film, but in the audio from the television broadcast, you can hear behind Scott Wapner, who's broadcasting
near
the floor of the
state,
behind the CNBC guy, you can hear traders groaning, oh, no, as though they're witnessing a sort of boxing match in which, you know, combatants are delivering death blows. It's a very colorful moment. But, you know, I think for a lot of people, in the context of how many lives are being affected by this battle, it's a fight that, as entertaining as it is, raises some questions about the effects of their actions on ordinary Americans.
By the end of the film, Herbalife has been sanctioned. Ackman still has his short on. Carl Icahn has been, as of this past December, appointed to President Trump's Regulatory Advisory Council. Do you suppose Ackman would think it's all been worth it?
You'd have to ask him. He's said some interesting things publicly. He said that this is probably the last big public short that Pershing Square, his fund, will engage in. He said it's just not worth the brain drain. In other words, the amount of energy and time that his firm has to commit. That said, he maintains his short position, and he continues to say, you know, regardless of whether the firm continues his investment, he's going to continue to work to bring Herbalife down. So,
it's a film called Betting on Zero by Ted Braun. Teaches at USC when he's not making movies like this. It's a fascinating film. It's a fascinating film. Ted, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. Pleasure to be on the program and pleasure to speak to your listeners.
The This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that President Trump's budget plan includes a bit more than $2 billion for the wall along the Mexican border. Final costs are expected to be a good deal more than that and are as yet unpaid for. Nevertheless, the Texas Observer reports that property owners down on the border have started to receive notices the government plans to seize their land in return for just compensation, of course. Eminent domain is what it's called. All right, we're done. That is all we got. The Dow off 15 points today, less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ basically flat, 5,900 again. The S&P 500 off 3 points, about a tenth or so percent. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Christy George, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troh are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.